Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning on the webinar on employment issues for troubled companies and companies in transition. I am Gary Kaplan. I'm special counsel here at Ferrella, Brown & Martell and co-chair of the Restructuring, Insolvency, and Creditors' Rights Group. And with me is Doug Dexter, a partner at our firm who is the chair of our employment practice group. First, wanted to get to a few housekeeping matters before we go through the substance of the program. First, please make sure that your phone is on mute so that it does not interfere with other participants. And also, if you could please turn off your BlackBerries or similar electronic devices or move them away from the phone so that they don't cause interference, that would be helpful.
Joining conference.
Lisa McEvely.
If you'd like to ask questions, there'll be an opportunity to do that either at the end of the program or during the program. You can submit questions online by typing in using the space at the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. There's a place to click on and type a question, and we'll try to address those either as we go or at the end, depending on the context. So without further ado, I was going to jump in and just tell you briefly what we're planning to cover today, and then we'll get down more to the substance of the program. One of the roughly six major topics we're planning to cover today, the first is managing downsizing and wind-down issues for a company that's in distress or in transition.
Joining conference.
Then we're going to talk about the WARN Act and some issues and traps for the unwary, followed by some discussion about managing employment issues in an asset sale. And then we're going to talk about liability or potential liability for unpaid wage and vacation pay of employees. Then we're hoping to cover some trust fund tax liability issues. And we're going to wrap up with some severance and employee termination liability issues. So let me turn it over to Doug now to talk about some of the issues with managing downsizing and wind down issues generally.
Thanks, Gary. Of course, when the workforce gets a sense that there's going to be a either a significant reduction in force, a wind down, or maybe even the elimination of a work group, one priority is making sure that you hold on to the right people to help with the transition. And a common way to incentivize people to stay, because of course we can't force people to stay in a job, even an employment contract for a specified period of time is not going to be specifically enforced to require someone, even if you wanted to go down to court, require someone to stay. The only way to keep people in the chair is with incentives. And so generally the incentives are going to be set up with choice people. And, you know, it's so very important to make sure that you limit this to people who you really do need, because it can get pretty expensive if that kind of discipline is not exercised. Choice people that will agree to remain working, and you know, again, people who you think will actually work out of their own sense of pride and devotion to the company, to a specific date or a specific event that's called out in the agreement that's entered into at the time that people are notified that there's going to be some form of wind down. You know, of course, there's a certain level of trust you got to have with the folks that you sign up for these stay agreements, because while you're going to have clauses in there that say we can terminate you early, before the date or the event, if you don't perform and you lay out specifically what you mean by not perform, of course, last thing you want to do is have to try to argue over that or litigate over whether or not the person was performing in the middle of the chaos that may be involved in a wind down. So you include some form of good cause early termination, but the idea is that if you got it out and you're productive, you will receive some form of bonus. the agreement's going to provide that the employer, of course, can let the person go in advance of the specified date, but if it's the employer's choice and there isn't good cause due to, you know, lack of performance by the individual, then that bonus is paid out regardless. So the employee has confidence that their loyalty, their remaining at the organization while others are departing, is going to be rewarded.
Joining conference.
Now, Gary, I know that you can't be the employee can't be absolutely confident that in bankruptcy that special type of agreement is going to be either enforced, perhaps because it'll be viewed as a preferential payment, or necessarily that the payment that's called for in the bonus will be given priority as a wage. Can you give us a little bit on that?
Yeah, Doug. In fact, now there were some changes to the bankruptcy code made about 5 years ago that limit the enforceability of some of these claims for severance or termination-related claims under an employment agreement. And they essentially either provide a monetary or dollar cap or are only enforced if certain conditions have been followed. And what happens is if the claims are not allowed under the bankruptcy code provision, they really get relegated to a lower priority. It doesn't mean they don't get paid at all, but they're not treated as a priority claim, the so-called administrative expense in the bankruptcy case, which is often the difference between getting fully paid and getting tiny bankruptcy dollars.
Okay, and, you know, aside from stay agreements with the particular people that you're trying to retain, the other common way of trying to avoid mass departures before you're prepared to downsize is agreements by employees, often as they come in the door, or if they're departing perhaps as part of their severance package, that they won't solicit your employees for a specific period of time. Unlike non-solicitation of customer clauses, which are generally unenforceable in California, non-solicitation of employee agreements, my agreement that once I depart my employer, I will not solicit my coworkers to go somewhere else, those are generally going to be enforced in California. Now, how effective they are legally, you know, is another matter, because of course how your employees are being solicited undercover on the side off the record is a difficult thing to trace. Commonly, if you see a acceleration or a large number of people going to one location that one of their leaders has recently moved to, you know, that's a pretty strong indication that that leader who has participated in the solicitation, and, you know, you may send a letter, or probably will send a letter to the new employer reminding them or advising them of the non-solicitation agreement, but the ability to bring, you know, the practicality of bringing a lawsuit over that issue is not very, generally not very strong, you know, because you're going to have to go out and try to identify who it is that made that initial call and what is, you know, what are the boundaries for solicitation and so on of an employee versus the former manager who signed the agreement, you know, mentions to HR that he'd be willing to entertain applications, or, you know, the employee, the subordinates themselves know where the manager's gone, and so there's an insistence that there was never any solicitation and so on. The more potent argument that to be made if you are looking to try to prevent a competitor from essentially, you know, raiding your employees during tough times or when there's a sense among the employees that the organization is under stress, is if you're able to demonstrate, identify evidence that the former employee engaged in the solicitation of your other employees while that solicitor was still working for you. Okay, if you got a manager who, before he or she departs, is soliciting their subordinates to come and jump ship with them, then you've got a very strong argument that that person has breached their duty of loyalty to you as an employer by misusing their access to their subordinates and misusing their position within the organization to, of course, undermine their employer. Particularly if they have not yet advised you, the manager has not yet advised you that they're planning to depart. You know, once they advise you they're planning to depart, then, you know, you probably well advised to keep an eye on what they're doing and maybe have them depart earlier than they had planned. Just because now you're on notice that they may be acting against your interests. But if they're doing it behind your back, you know, and you can find evidence of that, and you send that evidence to the new employer, that if they're well advised, that should stop them in their tracks on further attempting to, you know, raid or solicit your employees, because the new employer can be liable for that breach of the employee's duty of loyalty as essentially a co-conspirator with the manager's breach of loyalty while they're still working with the first employer. So, you know, other than that, in California at least, the idea that you can bring a lawsuit to try to stop quote-unquote employee raiding of a workforce is a very difficult argument to make, and generally as a lot of money gets spent on a lot of litigation activity that doesn't really result in very much very much of a consequence for two reasons. One, courts, absent proof that of sort of this breach of loyalty or maybe proof that trade secrets are being used to solicit the employees, courts are very unlikely to issue injunctions to stop people from moving around in the workforce, from changing jobs. And second, for companies, unless you're talking about a sales force, it's very difficult to prove lost, you know, revenue, actual financial damage for having lost any particular employee, even if that loss of the employee is ultimately determined to have been wrongful or illegal. Perhaps at most replacement costs for the employee, but trying to tie lost revenue to lost employees generally is a very difficult thing to do. As I mentioned, you know, a moment ago, the court system is much more, the legal system is much more receptive to the idea that rather than somehow protecting our right to our employees, that employers and companies certainly have a right to protect their intellectual assets. And often, you know, when you really boil it down, the concern about the departure of an employee, while they may be a very talented employee or may be viewed as a critical player at a critical moment in a struggling company's progress, ultimately it's often the intellectual asset that is the greater concern. And so we really encourage employers during good times and bad, but certainly at times when they have reason to be concerned about saving every asset they've got and retaining their most critical holders of those intellectual assets, to have employees sign non-disclosure agreements, but not just boilerplate generalized non-disclosure agreements, but non-disclosure agreements that really call out as specific examples the types of intellectual property that your particular business has an interest in protecting. Because if we need to go to court and enforce that non-disclosure agreement with respect to a specific type of information, the court's going to be far more receptive to both the argument that the information is a trade secret and protectable, and the request for an injunction preventing the use of that information if the specific information that we're complaining about at the time was called out in the non-disclosure agreement. So simply because we look far less like we are identifying that item after the fact. And we're far more credible in arguing to the court that we've always felt that this information was critical to our business and was in fact secret and protectable under the trade secret laws. So massaging and specifying information in NDAs, in my view, is just absolutely critical to protecting the assets of an organization, and this so often comes up when we're talking about an organization that's struggling for its continued existence and losing those key employees who hold that key information. When those employees do depart, I find it very effective and meaningful to document that we have shown the employee on their exit interview their signed NDA and confirmed with them in writing that we intend to continue to enforce that agreement. That simply because they're no longer working with us, that doesn't mean that they no longer have obligations to us, and that we will continue to enforce that agreement. Because, again, when they go to work for a competitor and we start to develop concerns that confidential information is being used, it's much more effective to be sending a letter to that competitor saying both, here's the NDA with the specific information we're concerned about called out, but also we're very serious about this, and we reminded the employee of that seriousness when we when that employee departed and we spoke with them in their departure. And I just think that is far more credible. As someone who's both sent and received those letters threatening legal action in protection of a trade secret, having noted that we reemphasize the point on the exit interview, simply demonstrates the priority at which the employer has held that protection of the trade secret and the like, and creates greater credibility that we hold it with sufficient priority that we are prepared to litigate, and that warning may be just all you need to effectively enforce the NDA through a voluntary cooperation of your competitor. So with that, Gary, should we transition into the question of the WARN Act?
Yes, thanks, Doug. So for those of you that are not aware of it already, the WARN Act stands for the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, which is a federal labor law that's codified at 29 U.S.C. sections 2101 and following. And many states have companion provisions. For example, California Labor Code, beginning at section 1400, has similar provisions. And as in the case of California, the state provisions can be more restrictive than the federal ones, as we'll talk about. So generally speaking, what the WARN Act requires is that an employer that has more than 100 employees must give at least 60 days notice of certain plant closings or certain mass layoffs. And there's several different trigger events. One of them is if there's going to be a plant closing at which 50 or more employees are going to be lost, then a WARN Act notice must be given. And we'll talk about in a minute what that means. But essentially, it must notify the employees of the fact that the plant's going to be closing or that they're going to be laid off shortly. Likewise, if there's a layoff of more than 500 employees, regardless of whether it's a plant closing or not, there's got to be a notification for that at least 60 days prior. And similarly, if for companies that have layoffs between 50 and 499 employees, there's got to be notice as well if more than a third of the workforce is being laid off at the time. And there's some exceptions to those general rules. For example, one of them is for part-time employees or employees that have been working there a short term, they're not entitled to this WARN notice. So, for example, we must apologize in advance. They're doing a fire drill here in San Francisco. So if you hear some sirens in the background, please do not be alarmed. So anyway, the WARN Act does not apply to employees that have worked for less than 6 months in the prior 12-month period prior to the layoff or the plant closing. It also does not apply to workers who have worked an average of less than 20 hours per week during that prior period. Now, the California WARN Act provisions, as I said, are more restrictive. They require notice for employers that have 75 or more employees rather than 100 employees, which is the federal benchmark. And there's no exception under the California law for part-time workers. Everyone has got to get the notice once the company is of sufficient size. And another restriction is the California WARN Act requires notice of layoffs of 50 or more employees no matter what, regardless of whether that's more than a third of the workforce or not. And somewhat counterintuitively, the WARN Act provisions actually apply to the white-collar workers, managers and supervisors, not just the hourly wage folks or other salaried workers. And in addition to giving the notice to the employees themselves that are subject to the layoff or to the plant closing, other notices must be given as well. For example, any employee representative, such as the head of a union, must get the notice at the same time the employees get it, and the chief elected official for the locality, which is typically a mayor, also must be given notice of the WARN Act. And Doug's going to now talk about some other exceptions that apply to the WARN Act.
And more generally, if you're talking about a temporary facility or a employee who has been advised when they're hired that they're being hired temporarily. You know, commonly this most commonly comes up in seasonal workforces. So if we got a ramp up, for example, in retail for the holidays or in agriculture for a harvest period, you know, of course, it's very important that we're clear with employees that they're being hired temporarily. Reason two bullet points down that this 50 employees or more can accumulate over a period of time. So very important, even though you're not thinking of, okay, on X date we're going to let go of X number of people, if over a 3 month period you're going to gradually wind down something, or there are going to be employees who temporarily come in and then eventually gradually leave. It's really important that we keep those temporary employees off of the tally of what might constitute a layoff, mass layoff. Closing a facility or a unit because of a union collective bargaining activity, strike or lockout, as long as there wasn't any intent to evade WARN, doesn't count. But this next bullet point, I think, is really the most important one, because it comes up the most often and can really blindside you. And that is that although generally the statute provide for a window of 30 days to define whether or not you've lost 50 or more employees. So as you know, generally the idea is that a mass layoff looks at a 30-day window. There is a reach out provision that says that if there are layoffs within a 90-day period, but they're for all caused by the same reason, whatever, you know, and that's of course a phrase that many lawyers can argue over the meaning of. If the layoffs are for quote unquote the same reason, then that's a 90-day window. Okay, so you may have a layoff, the first of which is only 20 employees, and then a month and a half later, you lay off another 20, and then 2 weeks later, you lay off another 20. You're up to 60. Now, all of those people who got laid off were covered by the Warren Act. So you have to try to envision where it is that you're going with your wind down, and not assume that just because one particular layoff event fails to hit the trigger the Warren minimum that you're not going to be covered by Warren. You know, and the other consideration is whether in fact you do have a layoff. If someone is losing their employment for less than 6 months, or if their hours are not reduced by more than half over a 6 month period, then that's not considered to be a layoff. If on the other hand, someone is having their work hours reduced by at least half for a full 6 month period, perhaps counterintuitively, that is considered to be a quote unquote layoff for Warren Act purposes. So, you know, you are trying to look at this big picture, and you are trying to figure out at the early end whether or not you are going to be experiencing a Warren Act event. But of course, in the real world, even the Warren Act recognizes that there is unpredictability in business, right? And so we have some exceptions recognizing that unpredictability or practicability of giving Warren notice. So, for example, the faltering company exception provides that if you, as a company, were seeking capital in other words, seeking some form of loan or investment in order to avoid a shutdown, then the Warren Act obligation is stayed for that period of time where you're trying to obtain capital, recognizing that if you gave Warren notice and employees started to leave because they recognized that they weren't likely to have a job any further after a couple of months, that's going to severely impact your ability, inhibit your ability to get that financing. One thing to understand is the distinction between that investment funding and sale. The faltering company exception doesn't apply to the idea that we're going to sell the company. It only is that we were going to invest in the company. We're going to get investment in the company. Now, a company may decide that they're going, because, for example, you're trying to sell the company and you don't know whether or not you're going to be successful at that. Because if you do and doesn't result in loss of employment, the employees have transitioned, there isn't going to be Warren Act liability. But you can't necessarily know that if you're in the position of trying to sell the company and because there's financial problems and you don't know whether or not you're going to be successful. It may be a perfectly valid business decision to say we're not going to give Warren notice, but if we have to terminate people, we're going to pay them out the 60 days notice as part of a severance, because the only obligation to the employees under Warren is to pay out the 60 days of compensation, whether it's through notice and they continue to work, or whether it's just a check.
Joining conference.
So that's a common, you know, issue that companies struggling and looking for either a investor or a purchaser
isn't working.
Have to sort out.
I'd rather than me deal with it.
Okay.
I think somebody's got their phone unmuted, so we can hear you.
Okay. No problem.
The next exception is the unforeseen business circumstances exception. And what's really important to understand first out, coming out of the blocks on that exception, is while it exists under federal Warren, it doesn't exist under California Warren. So if you get advice or you find materials that tell you that if you know you're surprised by a sudden downturn in your business that you had not been able to foresee, that can excuse you from part of your WARN notice obligation. That doesn't apply. You need to understand it doesn't apply in California. The unforeseen business circumstances exception says if you get blindsided by some sort of financial catastrophe, you won't be liable for having failed to give your employees the full 60-day notice. What you're obliged to do is give notice to employees as soon as you know that you're likely to have layoffs that will trigger WARN, you've got an obligation to give the notice. So the unforeseen business circumstances exception, as is the faltering company exception, are excuses that can shorten the period of notice, but they're not excuses to avoid the notice. It's worth noting that at this point, the statutes allow, they recognize that 60 days out or whatever the period is out where you get the sense that you're going to have to do layoffs under these exceptions, either way, you're allowed to get, you may not know the exact date that you're going to have to lay people off, so the legal system, the WARN Acts allow for you to give ranges to employees, that during a specific range period of time, generally a two-week period of time, no greater, we're telling you you're going to lose your job. Now, of course, you have to give it 60 days in advance of the earliest possible date of that layoff, and as you get a stronger sense as the employer when that date is going to be, you need to update your notice, but you don't necessarily need to give a specific date, and on the flip side of that, it's not really an excuse to say, well, we didn't know the specific date, because you're allowed to give a range. The last exception is for natural disasters, of course, again, unforeseen circumstances that result in a plant closure or a necessity to engage in a mass layoff. As I mentioned, liability for WARN noncompliance is fairly limited. You've got simply the obligation to pay the wages in lieu of notice to employees. Recognize, however, though, that you can't condition that payment of any of the 60 days pay upon anything such as a release or anything else you might ask if you were asked of employees in exchange for what otherwise might be a severance package. This is mandatory payment if WARN is triggered. There's also an obligation of $500 a day if you fail to give the local government the notice. But the real serious issue is the back pay. And we can tell you that class action lawsuits to recover WARN Act pay are extremely common because they're so simple and straightforward for lawyers to bring. Because there's just automatic that everyone, who got laid off is in the same boat, has common issues, so it's very difficult to argue that it's not appropriate for class certification, and the damages are simple, and the issue is simply going to be, was there a reason why, or was WARN not triggered, or was there a reason why the notice was allowed to be laid under the exceptions. But, there are a lot of lawyers out there who keep track of plant closings and layoffs and will go through the WARN process with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that these obligations have been met.
And Doug, is there a way to try to limit potential WARN liabilities either in an asset sale agreement or in an employee's severance agreement?
In the asset sale agreement, absolutely. And, in fact, the regulations encourage that the buyer and seller in an agreement, in an asset sale arrangement, agree upon who is going to take on Warren liabilities, and that's, of course, very common these days to include. In terms of the employee, no, Warren liability is not waivable, and we can't negotiate effectively negotiate down with an employee what that Warren obligation might be. They can sign whatever we want them to sign and take 50 cents on the dollar, but they're still going to have an entitlement to bring an action for the balance.
I'm going to try and jump down to some issues that arise in terms of priority claims for employee wages and benefits in the context of an asset sale. And California has some statutes, and most states have similar provisions that set up a priority claim for employees that are not paid wages either for work done in the 90 days prior to a particular event that I'll get to in a second, or for employee benefits that are earned within the 180 days prior to that triggering event. And the triggering event typically is either cessation of the business itself, or if there's a formal proceeding that's commenced with respect to the business. For example, a receivership or what's known as an assignment for the benefit of creditors or a bankruptcy filing. All of those things give rise to this priority claim. And in California, it's $4,300 per employee. That number jumps, in the event of a bankruptcy case, that number jumps to about $12,000 now. It's actually indexed for inflation, so it increases gradually each year, but that's the total amount. And the way it works, at least under the California provisions, and like I said, most states are similar, if these priority claims are not paid and there's been a sale of the business, or a substantial portion of the business, then those claims must be fully paid off the top from the sale proceeds, even before the secured creditor that might have a lien on all the assets gets any money. So that's something you really need to take into account if there's unpaid wages or employee benefits, accrued vacation and the like. Those really need to be taken account of ahead of time because they're going to come off the top in any sale, and that's got to be incorporated into the sale consideration. And Doug now, I think, is going to talk about some other issues that arise in an asset sale in the employment context.
Sure, because, you know, commonly in the process of purchasing a company through the assets, the purchaser is going to be interested in trying to bring over the best employees and maybe not bring over the lesser performing employees. It's a natural desire to try to separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will. And the seller is going to be generally motivated to cooperate with that assessment because it's something the buyer wants. It's a dangerous place to go as a seller because the seller needs to think about this as if they are going to be making decisions to terminate the employees themselves, right? Because if the seller advises the buyer, well, this person's a keeper and this one's not, in blunt terms or in more subtle terms, and the knots aren't brought over, then there's a real risk that the people who aren't brought over may bring action claiming that the motivations for declining to bring them in with the new company are illicit for all of the reasons that they might bring an action in the first place for being terminated, either because I'm in a protected classification or it's retaliation because I've raised an issue or I've been out on leave of absence or any other reason why you might be legally concerned about having terminated the employee in the first place. And the seller will be named as a defendant in that action along with the buying entity being sued for having failed to hire, and the seller was brought in for aiding and abetting in that discrimination. There was also the risk of simple defamation claims for having, just as if you'd be concerned about in this modern age, given referrals to third-party employers who called you about your former employees and you know, for all the reasons that we generally, at least on the record, are neutral about our referrals to potential employers. This is even more of a risk because in this situation, the employee already has a stake, already has an interest in this employment, as opposed to just, you know, one of a multitude of places they may have applied for a job while they're unemployed. They're going to have much more of an inclination, again, to try to find out why they didn't get hired and do something about it. The slide indicates there's something called a qualified privilege for that type of information being passed between two interested parties. But the only thing that the employee needs to allege in order to overcome that privilege is that there was some malice involved in communicating the information. So it's dangerous legally for the seller to do much besides provide a list of who the employees are. Now, of course, the other thing that the seller wants is access to personnel files, because you're continuing to employ people based on what's in their personnel file. They'd like to be able to assess whether or not to hire them based on what's in their personnel file. But understand that the personnel file, of course, involves a right to privacy on the part of the employee, whoever is being referenced in that personnel file. And just as you would have no legal right, under California law at least, to take someone's personnel file and publish it in the local paper or to walk out on the street and hand it to somebody else, you have no greater right to hand it over to the buyer of an entity that is considering, you know, purchasing your assets. In order to hand over that personnel file, really, you need to obtain a waiver from each employee accepting the idea that the personnel file can be turned over. And once the sale is public, or at least known to the employees, then they should have a motivation for allowing the buyer to consider, their record in considering whether to hire them, but you need to have individualized waivers from those employees before handing over the personnel file. As long as we're talking about handing things over, if there is an asset sale, you need to understand that this the idea of the vacation accrual bank that you would have to pay out to an employee who was terminating, all those employees at the time of the asset sale are in fact terminating with the selling entity. Their employment is terminating, technically. So there's an obligation to pay out their vacation accrual bank unless they agree in writing that you can transfer that accrual bank to the purchasing company. And that's a very substantial it's a significant liability that can blindside you, because what is the consequence or penalty for failing to pay out vacation at the time of termination? 30 days of pay, 30 working days of pay, month and a half penalty for each person who doesn't either get their vacation pay paid out at the time, or accrual paid out at the time of the asset sale, or sign off on an agreement to transfer that obligation to the new employer, right? Because technically the idea is that the employees have to agree that they're going to transfer that obligation to a new creditor, in other words, the new employer, while they currently have a debt that is owed by the selling entity. In terms of buyers, of course, the buyers need to be conscious of who it is that they want to try to retain once the company once the assets are acquired, or even the company is acquired, because of course in this day and age, people are often the greatest assets of an organization. Requiring people to stay, as we discussed earlier, is a tough thing to do unless you're prepared to offer them bonuses to stay. Because imposing non-competes on employees in California is generally not enforceable unless the non-compete is entered in conjunction with the sale of an asset by the person who's agreeing not to compete. Therefore, the buyers certainly want to retain the people who own the business, to have them continue working, or want to prevent the people who own the business from competing once those people have sold them the assets of the business. They should and can legitimately obtain a non-compete from those selling owners, but not from the line employees. As I mentioned a moment ago, we've got an obligation to pay out vacation pay. What are the obligations of the corporate owners or managers to pay unpaid wages if the company goes under? Generally, under California, managers and corporate owners do not have an obligation to pay statutory wages. For employees who went unpaid at the time that the company dissolved or stopped doing business. However, the Ninth Circuit recently held that even after a bankruptcy, the controlling managers of the company might be liable for unpaid wages due under federal law, which is basically the wage itself and overtime for hours worked over 40. So there is not an absolute certainty that the people who are the controlling managers of a business are going to walk away without an obligation to pay wages out of their own pockets simply because the organization is going into bankruptcy. And finally, with respect to the penalties for non-compliance with wage rules, such as not issuing appropriate pay stubs and other penalties that may arise under the labor code, it's not clear whether a manager might be liable for those penalties. But that's pretty uncommon. I mean, generally, what you're that type of an action against an manager. The real issue is what is the wage itself, and if the plaintiff's lawyers are not going to be able to recover the wage against the manager, they're generally not going to be, in my view, they're not going to be pursuing the penalty against the manager. Okay? Let's see. This isn't moving.
So now I'm going to talk about some potential trust fund tax liability issues. Under the Internal Revenue Code, and this is at 26 U.S.C. Section 6672, a so-called responsible person, and we'll talk about in a moment what we mean by that, can be liable for the willful failure to pay certain trust fund taxes that are owed by the employer. And trust fund taxes include things like, typical payroll tax that the employer withholds from the employee and is supposed to remit to the government. And the penalty can be very severe for the so-called responsible people that fail to make sure that money gets paid to the government. Is actually 100% penalty for this willful failure to collect and pay over the tax. Essentially, it's making the responsible person fully liable for the tax that should have been paid. Now, the responsible person has been the subject of a lot of litigation, but generally speaking, It's someone that's got the power to control the decision-making process by which the company determines whether to pay creditors versus paying the government on these withholding tax obligations. And the courts that have looked at this focus essentially on who's got the duty to oversee, manage, or administer the financial affairs of the company, especially with respect to deciding who's going to get paid among the creditors versus whether the government will be paid. And in terms of the willfulness component, that can be shown really by implication, and courts have found that if there's a voluntary conscious decision to prefer some creditors over paying the government, that's enough to satisfy the willfulness requirement to make the individuals, the so-called responsible individuals, personally liable for these taxes. So the bottom line is, if you're a principal of one of these companies, you don't want to play with fire here. You want to make sure those taxes get paid no matter what, even if it means that some supplier is about to cut you off, because you could be personally held liable for the full amount of those taxes. And I should point out that there's usually comparable provisions under state law for both payroll taxes and other types of taxes like sales and use taxes. The one exception to this potential liability, though, is if someone really has a nominal role. For example, let's say there's a bookkeeper that's just cutting the check, but they're taking the direction from a manager or an officer, they would not be personally liable because they're not the ones that are essentially making this decision. One other thing I should also mention is that these trust fund tax liabilities are generally not dischargeable or able to be wiped out in a bankruptcy case by either the employer or by the individual that's personally liable. So it's not the sort of thing where you don't have to worry about it if you file bankruptcy. These things will stick around no matter what. Now, I think Doug is going to try and address some other issues involving severance and employee termination liability.
We've got commonly in particularly smaller businesses existence of change of control provisions in employment agreements. And so it's very, very, I mean, they can be very substantial payouts. So it's important that either buyer or the seller in the process of a asset sale or even sometimes a stock sale be conscious of who has change of control provisions and what the triggers are and how much the payments are. We've also, of course, when you're a purchaser, you want to be conscious of what severance agreements otherwise are out there, either under individualized agreements or company policies, because those can be hidden liabilities as well. And, of course, when we're doing it, I'd say, of course, because it's very common in my practice, but I think sometimes not so obvious to those who are going through layoffs for the first time, when we're doing significant layoffs where we're deciding among various employees in the same job classification, it's very important to take an analysis of what the impact is of your proposed layoff selections on the protected employee classifications of gender and race and age and so on, because it can surprise you sometimes once you lay that out on, say, an Excel spreadsheet, you know, that you are in fact laying off, you know, most of the people over the age of 40 in your organization. You're laying off the three oldest people in your organization, right? Or all of the females in a job classification, and those issues often won't be lost on the employees or on lawyers that they go speak with. And in fact, in order to get, as many of you probably know, in order to get valid release agreements from employees over the age of 40, you're going to need to literally provide them with a list of those who are being laid off and those who are not being laid off by job title and what their ages are. So it's going to be presented to them in black and white. So it's important to take into consideration what those impacts are and maybe adjust your layoff plans once you identify some disproportionate impacts. among those categories that may not immediately be obvious is taking into consideration whether any of the people that you're looking at have recently been on medical leave, because that is becoming a very, very common manner in which terminations are being challenged. That I'm being terminated within a short period after I took a FMLA or other form of medical leave, and there's a logical argument that they can sometimes make that I became less valued and suddenly at the bottom of the list once I took that medical leave, particularly in a stressed company.
So I want to just point out that if there's a subsequent bankruptcy filing by the employer, there's some limitations on the liability under these employment agreements or severance agreements that Doug was just discussing. First, there's a bankruptcy code provision that would disallow damages that result from termination of an employment agreement to the extent they exceed 1 year's worth of compensation. So, for example, an employer has a 5-year contract and the contract gets essentially terminated because the company goes into bankruptcy. The employee only gets a claim for 1 year's worth of compensation, not for 5 years. And also, there's limitations. Even if there's severance agreements that the employee has signed ahead of time, those can also be limited in bankruptcy as well. Rather than being completely cut off, though, this is the concept of having a limited priority claim that we talked about earlier. And the way it would work is the priority claim would be limited first for severance. It would be required that the severance that's being paid is part of a program that's generally applicable to all full-time employees. If you're talking about severance of so-called insider, like a director or officer, they cannot get a severance payment as a priority claim in the bankruptcy case unless there's severance set up generally for full-time employees. And there's also a quantitative cap on the severance that can go to a so-called insider. Again, that's generally an officer, a director, or other control person. And the severance payment can't be more than 10 times the average that's been paid out to non-management employees during the same calendar year for severance. So those employment agreements that have severance provisions may not be enforceable by their terms, may be limited by their terms. I see we're running up on 11 o'clock, so I just want to quickly cover our final issues, which involve dealing with so-called ERISA employee benefit plans. ERISA, as you may know, is the federal law that sets the standards for private sector employment plans, both pension and so-called welfare benefits. And the fiduciaries of those plans may have liability when those plans get terminated under federal law. And a fiduciary is either someone that's actually named as the fiduciary of the plan or someone that has discretionary authority or control or responsibility over the plan assets or the administration of the plan. So, number one, they've got to make sure, the fiduciaries must make sure that the proper forms get filed with the government. There's a form 5500 that must be filed annually, and contributions must be timely submitted or remitted to the plan administrator. There's also very specific provisions that govern plan termination, among other things. Usually there needs to be a formal resolution by the company to terminate a plan. And then there is, as I pointed out, there's a potential liability when the plan gets terminated, particularly in the pension plan context. Now, there's different requirements depending on whether it's a so-called standard termination or whether it's a distress termination, and there's particular provisions that talk about the limits of liability if the company is going through a so-called distress termination. So we don't really have the time to cover all these issues in detail, but these are the sort of things that you want to pay close attention to and make sure you get some expert advice on to, again, avoid potential personal liability as a fiduciary on these things. I wanted to just see if anyone had additional questions they wanted to ask over the phone rather than over the Internet. And if not, then we'll have some closing remarks. But if you have any questions, please take your phone off mute now and feel free to ask your question. Okay, well, hearing none, let me just say first, we'll be sending out to the participants in today's webinar a copy of the PowerPoint slide presentation for you to have, as well as some biographical information of Doug and I. And I wanted to just alert you to the fact that our prior webinars are available for free by clicking onto our website. There's a list of various topics that you may find of interest. I want to also point out our next webinar is going to be on November 3rd. On restart techniques for technology and IP-driven companies. And you can always check our website for future webinars after that. So I wanted to thank everybody again for joining us today, and we hope you all learned something. And feel free to call on us if we can be of any assistance in the future. Thank you.